sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Simcha Weintraub, the founder and rabbinic director of the National Center for Health and Healing. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Sameach, which means happy holiday. The holiday I'm referring to, of course, is the great Festival of Passover. Today is the sixth day of Pesach, last of the intermediate days of the festival, Chol HaMoed. Technically speaking, when you have a week-long Jewish holiday, and there are really only two that work this way, Sukkot in the fall and Passover in the spring, there is a festival day called a Yom Tov in Hebrew, or colloquially a Yontif in Yiddish, on the first and last days of the week-long festival. If you're Orthodox or conservative and don't live in the land of Israel, that is, live in, America, you add an extra day of Yom Tov to the beginning and end of the festival. If you're a Reformed Jew or do live in Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, you just have the one festive day at the start and end of the week. The in-between days are called Chol HaMoed, literally the ordinary days in the midst of the holiday. They represent a kind of paradoxical celebration. You do many of the rituals of the holiday. In the case of Passover, for example, you don't eat any leavened breads or cakes or other products, and you have certain additional prayers that you say, like Hallel, the service of praise, but you can go to work, drive a car, go to school, work in the yard, write and record a radio show, basically anything you would do if it wasn't Pesach. Except you only get to eat matzah and other unleavened foods. There is something subtle and quite wonderful in the concept of an ordinary day in the midst of a festival, or perhaps more beautifully, of a holiday quality in an ordinary day. It's a way of taking a day that would otherwise not seem different at all and making it special, and just slightly sacred. You know, not a day full of holiday preparations or with lots of rituals to fulfill or services to attend, but one that has a shading of sanctity, a bit of extra holiness, a little chasing of shimmering silver to make it special. Of course, we're not restricted in this concept to just the intermediate days of the Passover festival, and that might be the abiding lesson of this festival of freedom and springtime and celebration. How to find holiness every day. How to celebrate our own liberties, even when it's not the festival of freedom. Chol HaMoed it may be, but it's still Passover, which means we continue to eat matzah today and tomorrow, and if you're observing 8 days of Pesach, all the way up until our Mamuna festival on Tuesday night. By the way, Mamuna is a fabulous way to celebrate the end of Passover. It's a Moroccan Jewish tradition of great upbeat music, delicious Moroccan treats, a show, and an unusual and very beautiful event. It's coming up this Tuesday night only at Temple Emmanuel in partnership with the Weintraub Israel Center. You can enjoy beautiful music and magnificent food and treats in a cultural highlight of this festival season and a great way to end Pesach. And so to play us in this morning for the coming Mamuna celebration, Tuesday night, 6:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, here's the performer who will be featured at Mamuna, Clara Fota, singing Toi et Moi, You and Me, a story of immigration to a new country, in his case, to Israel from Morocco, a highly appropriate theme for Passover immigration, and of course for Mamuna, Tuesday night, 6:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel. Call 327-4501 for ticket information. That's 520-327-4501. But now, enjoy Claude Foto's Moroccan Jewish music.
Et amas on vit en Amérique, on a gardé la même façon d'agir, on vit en mémoire de souvenirs. Toi
toi et moi, nous venions du nord d'Afrique. Et Zama, on vit en Amérique. On a gardé la même façon d'agir. On vit en mémoire de souvenirs. On veut chanter, on veut danser. La nostalgie des fêtes du passé. Un petit verre, ça va s'arranger. N'oublie jamais les moments d'amitié.
That was Claude Fauta's song, Toi et Moi, for the coming Festival of Mamouna, You and Me, a celebration of the conclusion of Pesach. It's coming up this Tuesday night at Temple Emmanuel, 6:30 p.m. Call 520-327-4501 for ticket information. Healing has always been considered a Jewish profession, at least in the sense that so many Jewish doctors are also so good at what they do. But how does Jewish spirituality impact healing? What place does your relationship with God and with your own religious center impact your recovery from illness? The founder of the National Center for Health and Healing, Rabbi Simcha Weintraub, will ask and answer some of these questions when we return on Too Jewish.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU. Dream it. Do it. Visit asu.edu.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Simcha Weintraub. He's a rabbinic director of the Jewish Board of Family and Children's Services, one of the nation's premier voluntary mental health and social service agencies, serves more than 60,000 New Yorkers. His major responsibilities are with the New York Jewish Healing Center and the National Center for Jewish Healing, both local and national service, educational, and resource agencies that draw on Judaism to provide this for the spiritual needs of Jews who are ill, families and friends, caregivers and rabbis, healthcare professionals, really everyone. He edited the National Center for Jewish Healing's first book, Healing of the Soul, Healing of Body, wrote another book, Guides Along the Way, a Jewish Spiritual Companion for Surgery, and is really one of the premier experts on healing in Jewish tradition. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
What are the key elements that you draw from in exploring meaning and approaches to Jewish healing?
What we find is that the two very rich axes for Jews are tradition and community. So we mine the tradition for what it might offer someone in their struggle and their journey, and of course we connect them with community, which is sometimes 90% of what they need is supportive connections. So a lot of our work is done in groups and in workshops.
You know, it's an interesting thought that healing isn't really something we do individually. We talk about God being the one who heals, but that it's actually a communal experience.
Yes, and the truth is the Jewish tradition has really stressed that people don't heal alone and require each other. The very famous teaching is that when you visit someone who is ill, you take away 1/60th of their suffering. And of course, right away somebody asks, well, then have 60 people visit and get it over with.
Right.
And the answer is that the visitor takes away 1/60th of what remains. So the truth is, it does decrease the amount of the individual's suffering. But you know, truth be told, the issue is really isolation and kind of feeling alien on the planet, and all those experiences that people have when they're ill or bereaved. So connection, a gentle connection with other people, and especially people who can really understand what you're going through, is of this essence, really.
The Jewish approach to healing is twofold. It's both incumbent on the person who's doing the visiting, Bikur Cholim, and of course the person who is ill. What's the first thing you tell someone who is going to visit someone who is ill?
To both be present, but to be silent. In other words, to see what the person really needs is the first thing. The classical teachings about Bikur Cholim is that a visit is successful if you respond to the needs of the individual, if you do some interpersonal support, and thirdly, if you pray for on the person's behalf for healing. So it's kind of a double message of both showing up, truly showing up and bringing yourself, but not obscuring what our tradition defines as the Shekhinah, the God's indwelling presence, which hovers over the person who's ill. So you want to be there, but you don't want to take up too much room.
We will talk much more with Rabbi Simcha Weintraub, exploring also what it means to try to recover in a Jewish way, when we come back on To Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke International, new sponsors here on To Jewish. What is Freedom Smoke International?
Thank you, Rabbi Cohan. Freedom Smoke USA is an electronic cigarette company based right here out of Tucson. We were the first store in the United States, the first store to have all FDA-approved products. It's a healthier alternative to cigarette smoking.
No smoke, no tobacco, and doctors refer people to you.
That's correct. My doctor actually just gave me a glowing report from other patients he's had that I've been able to find this as a healthier alternative to smoking.
Cardiologists, pulmonologists, even dentists, huh?
That's correct. It does help with all that.
How many flavors can people get of this?
We have over 700 flavors available.
Where are the locations and how do people get connected?
Our first location is at River and Orange Grove. We opened one at Broadway and Swan, and we currently just had our grand opening at 12th and Valencia.
And we do have a store in Southern Michigan also.
And what phone number can people call?
You can call the toll-free number at 1-800-705-7013. That's freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thank you, and we'll talk some more next week. If you do have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, or stream us from there, or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Temple Emmanuel, Pilgrimage Trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan, is set for June 11th to June 23rd, 2014. This is just about your last chance to come with me on this fantastic journey to Israel, seeing all of the wonderful Holy Land from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to Masada to Jerusalem and much, much more. Please email twojewishradio18@gmail.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary of this great trip. Speaking of travel, you know, during one of my many trips to London, I became friends with a very wealthy but very modest Jewish guy named Hyman Goldfarb. On one visit, Hai told me that because of his generosity and hard work for the many charities he had contributed to over the years in England, the Queen had decided to knight him. But he told me he was going to turn it down. I was a little bit astonished. "That's a great honor," I said. "Why would you turn it down?" "Because," Hai said, "during the ceremony you have to say something in Latin, and I don't know any Latin," he said. "Well, why don't you just say something in Hebrew," I suggested. "The Queen can't possibly know the difference." "Brilliant," Hai complimented me, "but what should I say?" "Well, remember, you know, the four questions at the Pesach Seder? You can say that in Hebrew, can't you?" "Oh, of course, Manishtana Halayla Hazeh," he said with a British accent that I can't fake. "Thank you, my American friend, I will become a knight." And so it was. At the ceremony, my friend Hai waited his turn. A number of other knight honorees went before the Queen, kneeled, went through the sword routine. Finally, they called his name. Hai knelt before Her Majesty. She placed her sword on one of his shoulders and then on the other and motioned for Hai to speak. But instead of Latin, out came, "Manishtana halayla hazeh mikol halelot." The Queen turned to her consort husband and said, "Why is this knight different from all other knights?" Sorry about that. Must be the matzah going to my brain or something. Anyway, on a more serious approach to Pesach, freedom, our Jewish Passover poetry slam this morning is from the magnificent poet Marge Piercy, a three-time guest of Too Jewish, by the way. It's excerpted from her great history poem, Magid, The Telling. The courage to let go of the door, the handle. The courage to shed the familiar walls whose very stains and leaks are comfortable as the little moles of my upper arm. Stains that recall a feast. The courage to abandon the graves dug into the hill, the small bones of children, and the brittle bones of the old whose marrow hunger has stolen. The courage to desert the tree planted and only begun to bear, the riverside where promises were shaped, the street where the empty pots were broken. The courage to leave the place whose language you learned as early as your own, whose customs, however dangerous or demeaning, bind you like a halter you have learned to pull inside to move your load. The land fertile with the blood spilled on it, the roads mapped and annotated for survival. The courage to walk out of the pain that is known into the pain that cannot be imagined, mapless, walking into the wilderness, going barefoot with a canteen into the desert, stuffed in the stinking hold of a rotting ship, sailing off the map into dragon's mouths. And so they walked out of Egypt. They bribed their way out of Russia under loaves of straw. So they steamed out of the bloody charnel house of Europe on overloaded freighters forbidden all ports. Out of pain into death or freedom or a different painful dignity into squalor and politics. We Jews are all born of wanderers with shoes under our pillows and a memory of blood that is ours raining down. We honor only those Jews who changed, those who chose the desert over bondage, who walked into the strange and became strangers, and gave birth to children who could look down on them, standing on their shoulders for having been slaves. We honor those who let go of everything but freedom, who ran, who revolted, who fought, who became other by saving themselves. Marge Piercy's poem, Magid. We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Well, Chag Sameach. Hope you've enjoyed your Pesach so far.
I have a question.
Sure.
How many pounds did you gain this Pesach?
Oh, my God. This is going to be a closely guarded state secret. I'm sorry. Even the Mossad can't get it out of me. That's the problem. You know, you're always hungry on Pesach. Something about the change in food. And so you keep eating and it tastes good. And never mind.
Yeah.
One of the really unique features of Pesach that a lot of Americans don't know about is the fantastic festival at the end of Pesach, which comes from your own Moroccan heritage, of Mimuna. Can you tell us a little bit about Mimuna?
Yeah. Actually, there is one explanation that I've learned not too long ago. And it's one of, you know, in our Torah, it's written Benisan Nigalu. So, like the Moroccan tradition, it's to take this new timing or a blessing of, you know, Nisan.
Of the month of Nisan, yeah, the month of Passover, the springtime month, yeah, the month of allergies.
Yeah, the time that the Israel people were saved or solved.
Oh, saved.
Yeah. And just to continue to celebrate this and to wish for, you know, so it will last for the rest of the year. Ah. And this is new. For me, it's not.
So Mimuna is a way of carrying the blessings of Passover and freedom forward for the whole year.
Yeah, exactly. And everything that Nisan is symbolized to Judaism, just to carry to the rest of the year.
So Mimuna came about in Morocco originally, spread everywhere in the Sephardic world, or lots of parts of the Sephardic world. And it comes at the very end of Pesach, and people would invite friends into their homes to break Pesach, to end the Passover, with freshly baked breads, freshly baked
Mufletot and sweets and homemade marmalades. And usually Moroccan family will work with a lot of joy and happy during all the week, preparing all the, you know,
special treats,
special and kosher for Pesach treats, which mean lots of coconut and almonds and nuts, and, you know, because you don't have flours, so
right,
they,
of course.
Yeah,
so you have to compensate with
and believe me, it compensates.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Plus lots of honey and sugar.
Yeah.
So mufleta is kind of a pancake, but kind of not. Can you describe it?
Yeah, mufleta is, I think the only thing it's like a egg roll paper.
Yeah, almost.
But it's much more tasty.
Much better.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. It's really, yeah.
It's like a thin crepe, but it somehow absorbs the sugar. It's just spectacular.
Mm-hmm. And zero calories.
Of course, no calories at all. Much, much healthier than the rest of what you've had over Pesach. Also, I should say, it's also traditional to have lots of great music, and we're going to have a big Mimuna celebration at Temple Emmanuel with Israel Center.
This Tuesday
night, 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
And we welcome
everyone, Tirbachu and Tisadu, which means this is the Moroccan blessing when... I didn't tell you this, but you know, in Morocco, everyone will open the door, and you don't need invitation. And some of the people, my grandmother still telling this story, that even if they would like to go to other homes, they will leave their door open, and people will feel free to go to an empty house full of treats without the hoster, and just to taste from the blessing of this house, and like to leave their blessing for this house. It's beautiful. It's beautiful tradition. So we are welcome, both of us, welcome everyone in Tirbachu et Tisadu, and come to Tuesday, bring your family, and you will enjoy the great music, treats, some dresses, some accessories.
Costumes, yeah. Some fezes, a little bit of everything. Should be a fantastic night. Everyone is welcome. Yeah. Mimuna Temple Emmanuel, Tuesday night, 6 o'clock.
Thank you.
Tirbachu v'tisadu.
Yafe.
When we come back on To Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And Chag Sameach.
And to you.
Happy Passover. We started talking last week about the question of Ger, immigration, movement, migrants, aliens, sort of this larger question of what it means to move. We Jews have been migrants ever since Moses, and of course in much more contemporary times, so many Jews in America migrated here at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. Let's talk a little bit about what migration means for us.
Well, before we get to that, I want to go back to something we touched on briefly last week but didn't really deal with. I mentioned one not-for-profit organization that deals with the remains of border crossers, whether they originate in Mexico or elsewhere further south. They come through Mexico and often die in the desert. I mean, far too many people per year die in the desert. And this one organization that I mentioned, Missing Migrants, tries to reunite the mortal remains of border crossers with their families, who are often in Mexico, but not always. But you were mentioning, if I remember correctly, a whole group of other organizations that in one way or another try to deal with this issue of border crossers. And since this is our nearest international issue, and it does have to do with fundamental humanity and maybe human rights or the right to seek a better life for yourself or your children, whatever, I'd be grateful, and I think maybe your listeners would be too, if you described some of the range of organizations that deal with this and whether they have any coordinating mechanism among them, and are they cooperative or competitive, et cetera, et cetera.
It would take maybe the whole show, not just a short segment, but I there are many different organizations, some of which deal primarily with trying to prevent deaths in the deserts. Others try to work with immigration reform. Some work cooperatively, like Humane Borders, with the Border Patrol, trying to stay closely within the law as they try to save lives, encouraging people not to cross. Others, while also trying to save lives, might put up water stations on somebody else's land. You know, there's a whole
range. And are these local, like here in Tucson, or all the way along the border from California through Texas?
Yeah, they're all along the border. Some are local, based here in Tucson, southern Arizona, because so many people cross here, and something on the order of 180 to 200 people a year, we think, lose their lives that have documented. There may be more. Just in this sector of the border.
So in our backyard,
in
basically,
our backyard,
not the whole border.
Yeah, what are we, 60 miles from the Mexican border, probably a little less so in places. So right along here, lots of people die, and they die as the Border Patrol, not just Border Patrol, the other government organizations affiliated, you know, Homeland Security with controlling the border area, direct people to different paths because there's too many coming in certain areas. If they're really strongly interdicting, trying to interdict drug supply coming across the Mexican border, that also pushes migrants farther away. The drug traffickers themselves, the cartels, control where people can cross. Sometimes they bring people over themselves. Some of the people coming over may be involved in the drug trade. It's a really complicated mix, and there's a lot of volunteer organizations that try to prevent people from dying in the desert, which is the principal issue, I think, for Jews. Pikuach Nefesh, saving a life, sets aside many other considerations. So that gives a little bit of an idea, but it's a complicated mix. There are some coordinating organizations, and people do tend to cooperate in trying to save lives because that's the principal goal, but it's complicated.
All right. Well, it's good to have that overview. Thank you very much.
May we come by next Pesach to a time when not so many people are forced into this situation.
Yeah, next year in Jerusalem.
We'll talk next week, Tom. Thanks.
Bye.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Jaime goes into a Catholic church and heads for the confessional. The priest asks him, "Tell me, why have you come, my son?" Jaime answers, "Some son, I'm 93 years old. My wife, who was 91, died a year ago. We were happily married for 67 years. But last night, I had crazy, great sex with us, 27-year-old supermodel." The priest is aghast. "When was your last confession, old man?" And Jaime replies, "Why would a Jewish man like me confess?" The priest is confused. "If you're Jewish, why are you telling me this story?" And Jaime replies, "I'm telling everyone!" Yes, that was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and tell everyone. ¶¶ And now a word of Torah. This week we read the great portion of Kedoshim, which includes the Code of Holiness, a description of the ethical injunctions that lie at the heart of Jewish practice. The code itself includes mitzvot that require us to assist the poor, to treat strangers, widows, and orphans with generosity and kindness. It insists on fair business practices, obligating us to live moral lives, tells us how to do so, and builds thematically to its great and most powerful message. That message is Ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, love your neighbor as you love yourself, one of the most powerful and complex of all moral instructions. It's important that this remarkable section comes in the precise center of the middle book of the Torah, Vayikra. Kedoshim, the holiness code, is in the middle of the middle of the Torah. That is, it forms the heart of the heart of our most sacred text. And at the heart is the ethical injunction to love your neighbor as you love yourself. This is an amazing and perhaps utopian ideal. Love your neighbor as much as you love yourself. If our society was actually rooted in such a conception, how much better it would be for everyone. But in true Jewish fashion, the Torah does not make this simply an idealistic statement and hope that people somehow live up to it. It is instead worked into a practical imperative. You see, Kedoshim builds up to this magnificent religious commitment with a series of ethical injunctions. Leave a corner of your field for the poor and the stranger. Don't leave a stumbling block before the morally blind. Care for the widow and the orphan. Be honest in your business dealings. Have equal weights and measures. Be holy because God is holy. That is, be ethical because that is the heart of holiness. The way to love your neighbor is by treating him or her both fairly and honestly, and it is that pragmatic approach to love that is just so Jewish. We are not obligated to convert our neighbors to our own views on things. We are not obligated to save our neighbors from their own belief systems. We are not obligated to change our neighbors into carbon copies of ourselves. We are not required to condemn our neighbors because they are slightly different from us. Rather, we are commanded to treat them as we would wish to be treated, respectfully, honorably, honestly, charitably, generously. Frankly, this is exactly what our society today needs most. This is true love of one's neighbor, as expressed in a functional, healthy world. Not coercion, concern. Not compulsion, care. Not elitism, egalitarianism. May we learn to so shape our own public life in these ways, and may we do so speedily and soon. There has been a movement to seek healing in spiritual sources for quite a while now, and Rabbi Simcha Weintraub has been at the forefront of that movement. The founder and rabbinic director of the National Center for Health and Healing, he will explain why healing is something we all can seek in spiritual ways and how we can help one another in that pursuit. Find out how when we return on Too Jewish.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU. Dream it. Do it. Visit asu.edu.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Just before Passover began last week in Overland Park, Kansas, a lifelong anti-Semite and neo-Nazi embodied the profound stupidity and moral bankruptcy of race hatred when he attempted to shoot up the Jewish Community Center and the Jewish retirement home there. 73-year-old former Ku Klux Klansman Frazier Glenn Cross, an ex-con and known purveyor of hate literature and websites, murdered a highly respected family physician, Dr. William Lewis Corcoran of Overland Park, Kansas, 69 years old. Corcoran's grandson, Griffin Underwood, a 14-year-old ninth grader, a singer and a member of the debate team at his high school, and Teresa Rose Lamano, 53, of Kansas City, an occupational therapist. None of the three people he murdered was Jewish. The perpetrator of these senseless acts of violence, Cross is the founder and former leader of the Carolina Knights of the Ku Klux Klan and the White Patriot Party, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitors such hate groups and has had dealings with Cross. Both of Cross's organizations operated as paramilitary groups in the 1980s. In the late 80s, Cross spent 3 years in federal prison on weapons charges for plotting the assassination of Southern Poverty Law Center founder Morris Dees. The short 3-year sentence was a result of a plea bargain he struck with federal prosecutors in exchange. He testified against 14 white supremacists in a sedition trial in Arkansas back in 88. He was reviled in white supremacist circles as a race traitor and for a while kept a low profile, according to a Southern Poverty Law Center profile of him. He's now making a comeback with the Aryan Alternative, a racist tabloid he's been printing since 2005, and with his websites. Cross, who has federal convictions on his record, had 3 guns on him when he was arrested. He would not have been able to obtain the guns he used in the murders legally, as he would not have cleared federal background checks. Instead, he got them from a straw buyer, a middleman with a clean record who buys weapons legally and then sells or gives them to people like Cross, allowing him to avoid federal background checks, a loophole that we must close. A capital murder charge has been filed against Cross and includes shooting deaths of Corcoran and his grandson. The ultimate penalty would be death. An additional premeditated murder charge was filed in the shooting murder of Teresa Lamano, an occupational therapist who was making her weekly visit to her aged mother who happened to be in a Jewish old age home. Authorities said there was enough evidence to warrant hate crimes prosecution in the case. We're still doing evidence collection, said U.S. Attorney Barry Grissom. We don't have all the evidence in, but to date, what we have to date makes me comfortable recommending that this move forward as a federal hate crime. Kansas reinstated the death penalty back in 1994. Since then, 9 people have been sentenced to die, but none of those executions have been carried out. In fact, the last executions in Kansas were Perry Smith and Richard Hickok, who were hanged 49 years ago, exactly 49 years ago, for the killings that inspired the book and movie In Cold Blood. The fact that Cross attempted to kill Jews just before Passover and succeeded instead in killing Christians places in stark relief the profound idiocy of racial and religious hatred and stereotyping. There's nothing good or moral or meaningful in the lives of men such as this. Our hearts go out to the families of these murdered people, good people, faithful, contributing citizens who were brutally killed by a man who should never have been able to obtain the weapons he used to do this. Frankly, we should be able to keep creeps like Cross out of society, and we must be able to keep guns out of their hands. In other news, in a terrorist attack just before Pesach last week, Israeli Police Chief Superintendent Baruch Mizrahi, 47 years old, a resident of Modin, was shot and murdered while driving to Hebron for Seder. His wife, who is 28 years old, was also in the car. She sustained moderate wounds to her torso and was hospitalized. A 9-year-old boy in a nearby vehicle was lightly injured in the shooting. Mizrahi, a father of 5, was a department chief in Israeli Police's Signal Communications Intelligence Unit. Before enlisting in the police, he served in the IDF for 25 years in various positions, including as lieutenant colonel in an intelligence unit. The U.S. State Department condemned the attack, saying it supports Israel's efforts to bring the perpetrators to justice. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu of Israel offered the bereaved family his condolences and said the attack was a direct result of the Palestinian Authority's incitement. The Palestinian Authority keeps broadcasting on its official channels messages that incite against the existence of the State of Israel. This incitement translated into the murder of a father who was driving with his family to celebrate Seder. He also criticized the Palestinian Authority for not quickly condemning the heinous criminal act. Economic Minister and Habayit HaYehudi leader Naftali Bennett said the Palestinian Authority, headed by Mahmoud Abbas, encourages and funds killers of Jews on one hand, and with the other hand, it blackmails Israel into releasing murderers. They seek terror, not peace. Later in the week, Abbas did in fact condemn the attack, sort of, but compared it to the Palestinians who have been killed in the past year. Better late than never, I suppose, and better something rather than nothing. In other unhappy news, in Ukraine, the part that's now controlled by Russian activists trying to steal it for Russia, Jews have now received communication requiring them to register themselves and perhaps their belongings or face a fine. A scary possibility. In happier news, Aruba, Jamaica, ooh, I wanna take you to Bermuda, Bahamas. Is Kokomo the top beach destination in the world? Well, not anymore. Last week, USA Today picked Tel Aviv, Israel, as its number one beach party location worldwide, ahead of famous beach spots like Cabo San Lucas, Barcelona, Phuket, and Ibiza. Based on a new travel guide, the article listed Tel Aviv in first place for beach partying, ahead of Cape Town, South Africa, Goa, India, and my native city of Los Angeles. In a section on the best beach party spots on the planet, Tel Aviv's beach was especially noted for being the best place to chat up locals for information about parties happening everywhere in the city, even more than the beach itself being the pulsating hub of sea, sun, and moon worshiping celebration. Still, first place is first place. Tel Aviv was commended on its lax business licensing, which leads to a myriad of clubs popping up literally overnight. Having been in Tel Aviv a little less than 2 years ago, accidentally during the gay pride parade, I can tell you that at that time, the beach was one enormous party, all very peaceful and upbeat, with music and dancing literally for miles in both directions. Of course, there was one section that wasn't joining the party, the Orthodox beach area, which alternates between male and female on different days of the week and has large walls separating it from the surrounding parties. I believe the music might just creep over the walls. So, Tel Aviv, number one place to party on the beach in the entire world. I'm not sure this was a big part of the original Zionist dream, but it is surely a big part of Israel's reality today. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Simcha Weintraub. He's the Rabbinic Director of the Jewish Board of Family and Children's Services, one of the nation's premier mental health and social service agencies, serves both a New York constituency, which is not small, and a national constituency in his role with the National Center for Jewish Healing. You've written pretty extensively on Jewish healing. Tell us what's different, if you will, about being Jewish and sick.
What comes to mind right away is that Jews are not alien to suffering as a collective, and I mean suffering in the broadest sense. And so the experience of loss or disruption or rebeginning, having to adjust to a new normal, is kind of part of Jewish history. So on the one hand, it's not unfamiliar to us, but on the other hand, the Jewish community, let's say in the United States and elsewhere, has really invested in medicine and believes, you know, strongly and happily in the promise of technology and doctors and specialists and all that's for the good. But one thing that's been neglected in the process is the dimension that's that we call spiritual. But what it means is the whole picture, the whole person. So Jewish healing developed in contemporary life in the early 90s, when a number of rabbis and rabbinical students were talking about Jews who were turning to Buddhism or even Christian Science, because they weren't finding in their own communities or in their own traditional texts the resources for healing, for integrating what's happening to them and somehow making it through with some sense of direction and meaning. So the purpose of the Jewish healing movement was really to help Jews access what is, in a sense, right under our noses in our tradition. So much of my writing has been about just connecting the dots between what people experience and what our tradition has to offer through its stories, its wise sayings, its rituals, etc.
You know, I recall when healing in the 90s began to become a popular approach. Some of it came out of a response to the HIV/AIDS crisis. And a lot of us started doing healing services and discovered that there was a lot of interest the first time, and then it just dropped down really quickly thereafter. Some places it maintained a very strong presence. Was that not the right way to go?
It's interesting. I think that in some places that cancer was still a C word, and what we've seen in the past couple decades is a real, I guess it's, I would say it's kosher now to talk about illness. AIDS was so terrifying and so cruel. And seemingly so hopeless that that it was a great response that people started healing circles and healing services. I think to sustain them, they have to grow, and there are waves. We have some groups that have thrived in certain years and then shrunk and regrown back. And I think we can't really, although some funders would like the deliverables to spell out exactly how many people showed up. The main thing is really one of organizing and making sure that the community is partnering together. The places where things have stuck and really made it through, and it isn't just because of persistence, but because they have partners, the Jewish Community Center, with the synagogues, with the Federation, with the Jewish Family Services. Everyone knows where the healing services are in the community, or where you can get a workshop on the Psalms, or even training and supervision to be a Bikur Cholim visitor, somebody who visits those who are ill. So really, it's a kind of an organizational challenge to keep it moving. There are some communities in the United States that have had healing projects for 20 years now and have never had more than $3,000 a year to work with.
So it's not just financial resources, of course.
Yes.
In dealing with some of the interesting challenges associated with healing, I think that in my own reform movement, the Mishaberach was an alien concept for a long time, and people credit Debbie Friedman with having reinvented it because she wrote a melody that everybody that caught on. Mishaberach was always a standard part of a traditional service, conservative, orthodox, any other, in which there's a prayer done at the Torah. What's different about the way people approach healing now? What's changed liturgically and experientially, do you think?
Well, for one thing, just to talk about the Mishaberach for a moment, it's become a real significant moment. In some congregations, I know they have added it to the Friday night liturgy.
Yes, we have too, right?
Yes, and in some more traditional circles, they now don't rush through it the way that they used to, as if the names of those who are ill needed to be quickly said and quietly, but rather allow congregants to stand up and say the name. And so again, it's about kind of putting illness on the map and acknowledging that it's very much with us and a concern. But I think that there have been attempts to make many, many things in Jewish life more healing. So, for example, I know of communities that have had a healing Seder on Passover or have used the holiday of Purim as an opportunity to talk about recovery from alcoholism and substance abuse and of course incorporating recovery in terms of mental illness too. So many things are kind of coming out of the closet and being approached, and much liturgy is being developed. I know of one professor at Hebrew Union College in Los Angeles who has been collecting Mishaberachs that he's uncovered over the centuries. Apparently, people wrote Mishaberachs for somebody going on a ship voyage or for all kinds of things.
Sure.
And so that freedom is something that I think we need to emulate.
When someone is diagnosed with a serious illness, what's the first place you think they should turn? And I'm thinking not, of course, medically, but spiritually.
Well, the very first place, I think, is trusted close ones.
So family members, close friends.
Family members, close friends, or close work associates that you can kind of begin to share the story. There's a lot of work being done now, actually, on diagnosis, because in our state of science right now, there's so many things that are diagnosed every day, and you know, now that people, thank God, are enabled to live longer, they accumulate diagnoses, and so there's a lot of study about a disclosure of one's diagnosis and where to take it at the beginning. I don't mind sharing. I was diagnosed last summer with early Parkinson's, and I was so happy that the neurologist explored with me at the very beginning who I wanted to share it with and how, and they were open to my bringing people to them, and they recommended Parkinson's for Dummies, you know, which is actually a very helpful book. Anyway, the point is, I think the first step is really trusted close ones. And then I think really to speak with other people, peers, who are dealing with similar challenges, because, you know, you just get a lot of strength, and again, that feeling of being an alien on the planet or carrying it all alone gets dissipated, and I want to stress how important it is for nobody to just take but to give, because it's what they call required helpfulness. So when you're in a support group, you know, the strength you get is not just from telling your own stories, but helping people with theirs. And so I think it's really important, after sharing it with trusted close ones, to find a peer organization or a support group, or even just a few individuals that you can find to talk to about their experience and you know, get some insight. The caution I would give there is that you don't want to speak to somebody necessarily who's far down the line in terms of symptoms and suffering. That could be very disturbing and not helpful. So if you can possibly find someone who's at a similar stage, or, you know, I think that's helpful. And I think one real question is how we talk to people. So you know, one may need to kind of reclaim a place of efficacy or agency, that's the word, in talking to one doctor, because there's some doctors who mean very well, but are scientists, and they're not thinking of, you know, of your wife or your kids or your boss or the other things that you have to contend with. And you may need to say to a physician that, can I talk to you about something that's not related to numbers and my body, but to how I work with this in the world. And I think more and more doctors are really eager to do that, because it actually encourages compliance and teamwork.
I want to talk a little bit, in the limited time we have left, about the challenge of a caregiver. We know how difficult it is to be a patient. We know a little bit about visiting the sick, but there's a tremendous stress on the caregiver.
Yes, we really should never be just talking about the identified patient, but about the system. And it really is true that sometimes the best window to help somebody who's suffering with an illness is to help the one who's trying to take care of them. That's sometimes, you know, the priority. So we don't do enough in terms of caregiver support groups and respite programs and materials. Our center actually came out with another book. You mentioned the one, Guide Me Along the Way for Surgery. We also came out with one called With Sweetness from the Rock, and it's a spiritual companion for Jewish caregivers. And I think we do have to think about these folks too, and in fact, there ought to be a Misha Berach for caregivers. We put one in our newsletter once, but I think both personal caregivers and healthcare professionals.
I want to thank Rabbi Simcha Weintraub for a thoughtful and conscientious visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about Jewish healing?
Our agency's website, our agency's initials are JBFCS, Jewish Board of Family and Children's Services. So if you go to www.jbfcs.org, you'll find the National Center for Jewish Healing and the New York York Jewish Healing Center and a bunch of resources.
Great place to go to find out more. Thank you again, Rabbi Weintraub.
Thank you. Thank you.
When we come back on Tuesday, and by the way, continue to feel better. Speedy.
Thank you.
should note to our listeners, he has a cold. I've got a little bit of a cough. That's, we all need Jewish healing.
True.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with me this morning on Two Jewish. I'm Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Stephen Smith, the executive director of the Shoah Foundation, speaking on the 20th anniversary of Schindler's List and the upcoming commemoration of Yom HaShoah. Our playout this morning on this last Chol HaMoed day of Passover comes from the irrepressible Doug Kotler, singing his own version of a Passover song, Wasting Away in Manischewitzville. My friends, Chag Sameach V'Kasher, a happy and kosher conclusion to Passover, Aziz and Pesach, and may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Nibbling on sponge cake, got such a headache. All of this matzah's starting to bind. Dayanu singing, and Tilly's bringing bowls full of brisket. One more bite, I'll go blind. Wasting away again in Manischewitzville. Searching for the Afikom and I give out. This endless meal has lost all its appeal. Now I know it's nobody's fault. It's not surprising.